2 weeks after the collapse of that Surfside condo comes the difficult decision to transition from rescue to recovery. The question is, what will officials do to bring closure to the scores of families who've lost their loved ones? Plus, tracking Tropical Storm Elsa after it made landfall in Florida. The question is, how bad will conditions get in the southeast and up the coast? And the deepening crisis in Haiti after the assassination of the country's president. Immensely poor, unstable, and increasingly violent. The question is, what's next for that already troubled nation? It's way too early for this. Good morning and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that will also bring some light amid these difficult headlines. I am Casey Hunt on this Thursday, July 8th. We'll start with the news. The political crisis in Haiti is growing deeper after the assassination of the country's president just over 24 hours ago. Jovenel Moïse was killed and his wife critically injured when officials say a group of highly trained and heavily armed assailants stormed his home in Port-au-Prince, speaking English and Spanish, and opened fire. His wife is now being treated at a Miami hospital. This video shows the scene outside of Moïse's home at some point during the attack, although we don't know who those people are. The head of Haiti's National Police Force says four of the suspects were killed and two others were arrested. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere and was already in the middle of a political crisis. They've had 15 presidents in the last 33 years. Moïse dissolved the parliament in 2020 and has since been ruling by decree. He had also been resisting calls to step down from opposition leaders who argued that his term ended this past February. He demanded that he serve out the remainder of the year and threatened to amend the Constitution to give himself more power. The country's interim prime minister, Claude Joseph, is now presenting himself as the head of state. Elections are scheduled for later this year. And back at home here, a difficult announcement for the families of the more than 80 people still missing from the sudden collapse of the condo building in Surfside, Florida.
It is with deep, profound sadness that this afternoon I'm able to share that we made the extremely difficult decision to transition from Operation Search and Rescue to recovery. At this point, we have truly exhausted every option available to us in the search and rescue mission. So today is about beginning the transition to recovery so that we can help to bring closure to the families who've been suffering and waiting for news.
So sad. A moment of silence, along with prayers with first responders, religious leaders, and public officials, was held soon after the decision was made to end rescue efforts. 18 more bodies were recovered on Wednesday, the biggest single-day spike in deaths to date. 54 people are confirmed to have died, and 86 remain unaccounted for. Rescue crews have been working nonstop for the last 2 weeks, searching for anyone who might still be alive. But no one has been pulled out of the rubble alive since hours after the Champlain Towers partially collapsed. The search, however, will continue for the bodies of those missing. Crews have removed 124 tons of debris so far, and it's now being sorted and stored in a warehouse as potential evidence in the investigation into why the building collapsed. All right, let's go now to the latest on Capitol Hill. Democrats are racing to push a bipartisan infrastructure bill through the Senate. According to multiple sources, Politico reports are familiar with the conversations. The White House's long sought after bipartisan deal could hit the Senate floor as early as the week of July 19th. White House advisors held a call yesterday with Hill Democrats to announce their expected timeline. Some Democrats reportedly cautioned that details of the bill could change while the White House threads a delicate needle surrounding a Democratic-only reconciliation package. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has previously vowed to schedule a vote for the bipartisan bill before the Senate leaves for August recess. There's also this. Despite vocal opposition to the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is expected to appoint some Republican members to the panel. NBC News reports McCarthy has spoken to several lawmakers and is signaling that he will not boycott the committee. Congressman Rodney Davis, the top Republican on the House Administration Committee, has publicly said he'd be willing to join. He was one of just 35 House Republicans who voted for the initial January 6th commission. A spokesman for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi confirmed that her office has not yet spoken to McCarthy about his potential picks or say if there were any members that she would outright refuse to allow on the commission. Ultimately, she does have final say over who gets to join the committee. Pelosi appointed her members last week, which included one Republican, Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming. Joining us now here on set, reporter for The Washington Post, Eugene Scott. Eugene, good morning. Great to see you again. Let's start with the January 6th commission, just because we've left off there. Kevin McCarthy deciding, okay, it's better if I participate in this. Right now, we don't get the sense that there are going to be any of the most inflammatory Trump supporters named to it. But that doesn't mean that Trump supporters aren't going to be named to the panel. What's your sense of what McCarthy's thinking here?
Well, he definitely wants a seat at the table to be able to help shape the narrative that Republican lawmakers, in addition to President Trump, were not in cahoots or as involved or turned a blind eye to what happened on January 6th, which is what so many Democrats, especially those farther to the left, have been arguing over the past 6 months. I think what we know Kevin McCarthy is going to want to do is perhaps try to preserve some sense of reputation for his party as, you know, we head into midterms next year and show that they are taking this issue very seriously, but they're not taking responsibility for this issue, despite what so many of their critics have said.
Yeah, I mean, part of me wonders, too. I mean, McCarthy obviously was very involved in speaking with the president that day. There have been reports that he's nervous about it. So at least this gives him some eyes and ears potentially in the background proceedings. Let's talk about infrastructure for a second, because now the White House is saying, OK, we want this. Let's see. It's July, what, 8th today? That's 10 days, essentially 10, 11 days before they want this infrastructure bill on the floor. There are so many potential speed bumps. We still don't know how much it's supposed to cost. We still there's just a lot of unknowns. And we also don't know if Democrats are going to be ready with a massive budget package to go right along with it, which Schumer has also promised. Do you think it's overly optimistic to think that this could actually land on the Senate floor this summer?
Perhaps not overly optimistic, but certainly optimistic. I mean, yesterday I covered Biden speaking about this, and he really wants Democrats to move forward. Like, you know, both sides actually have something that they're trying to be able to prove to constituents that they've been able to do. But this is complicated. That group of 20 moderate senators know that they want to come together, but how exactly isn't clear how they still want to fund this. But I think a lot of attention also is going to be, of course, on, you know, this budget reconciliation package that Schumer wants to get forward so that Democrats can say that these issues like, you know, child care and climate change, maybe even immigration, that they have long believed should be a part of infrastructure, are still moving forward despite all of the GOP opposition.
What's the White House's sense of, I mean, Democrats on the Hill are saying, look, we got to do these two things at the same time or we can't get progressives to pass it. Does the White House view it that way, too? Or would they prefer to see the bipartisan deal go by itself?
Well, I think what the White House wants to see is as much of the initial agenda that Biden proposed to move forward as possible. And if that means these both of these plans moving forward at the same time, they would back that. But that's going to be very difficult, especially at this timeline, to get done before the end of summer. But I think what they need to communicate to so many people that supported them is that they didn't lose as much as they may have initially looked during those weeks, you remember, where like no progress was being made. And so two looks like it would be a better plan than one.
Well, and I mean, I think at the end of the day, they're also thinking in terms of everyone is thinking about the midterm elections. And the idea is they have to, they cannot show up to those elections with nothing. So that
absolutely
is the most important thing.
Absolutely. Ads are being prepared, I imagine, as we speak.
The Washington Post's Eugene Scott, thank you so much for getting to be with us. We really appreciate it. Still ahead here, we are following the path of Tropical Storm Elsa as it brings heavy rain and gusty winds up the East Coast. Plus, New York City honors first responders and essential workers with one of the largest ticker tape parades in the city's history. This was so fun to see yesterday. We're going to have those stories and much more when we come right back.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win. Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Puck in behind the Tampa net. McDonough is on it there. Crunches it to the boards. Suzuki takes a hit from Chernak. Down to 15 seconds. Puck pinned to the corner to the right of Vasilevsky. Comes out in front. It is cleared as time winds down here in Tampa. 5 seconds remaining. Puck retrieved by Petrie. Lightning strikes twice.
And another pandemic hockey season the same way they did the last one, winning a second Stanley Cup championship in 10 months after defeating the Montreal Canadiens 1-0 in Game 5 last night at home. Honors for playoff MVP go to Tampa goalie Andrei Vasilevsky, who recorded his NHL record 5th consecutive series-clinching shutout. Congratulations to them. Meanwhile, in nearby St. Petersburg, baseball's Rays turned in another no-hitter that wasn't. 5 Tampa Bay pitchers combined to throw 7 no-hit innings against the Cleveland Indians in the second game of a doubleheader yesterday. But because it was only a 7-inning outing, the 4-0 win won't go down in the record books, making for the second time this season that a major league team has held its opponent hitless in a game without registering an official no-hitter. When are we going to get rid of this 7-inning situation? Anyway, all right, let's go now to Anaheim, California, where the Angels' Shohei Ohtani slugged his league-leading 32nd home run of the season, breaking the record held by Hideki Matsui for the most hits by a Japanese-born player in the majors. Ohtani launched the historic homer during the 5th inning of yesterday's 5-4 win over the Red Sox, his 81st game this season, while it took Matsui all 162 when he set the previous mark of 31 back in 2004. Ohtani, no surprise, is now also the top-seeded slugger competing in Monday night's home run derby at Coors Field out in Denver. And now there's this. With about 2 weeks to go until the Summer Olympics, Japan's prime minister has announced a COVID-related state of emergency for the Tokyo region. New restrictions will be put in place starting Monday and lasting through the games until August 22nd. It comes amid a rise in coronavirus infections. Tokyo reported 920 new cases yesterday, up from 714 a week ago. And there's this. Roger Federer will not win a 9th Wimbledon title this year, and he may never win another one. Playing in his first Grand Slam tournament since a pair of knee surgeries, the 20-time major champion fell in straight sets to 14th-seeded Hubert Hurkacz in yesterday's quarterfinal. After the match, Federer told reporters he's not sure he'll ever be back at the All England Club.
Was that the last time you'll play at Wimbledon, do you think, on centre court?
I don't know. I really don't know. I got to regroup. Of course, I would like to play it again, you know, but at my age, you're just never sure what's around the corner.
Is retirement an active possibility for the immediate future?
No, it's just about having perspective. I got to take my time and take the right decision and the one decision I want to take, you know, and where I feel most comfortable. So that's where it leaves me. But no, I hope not that that's going to happen. You know, the goal is to play, of course.
No matter what he decides, what a career. All right, finally, England will face Italy for the 2020 European Championship. I sort of can't believe it. Advancing to the final with Harry Kane's extra time goal that put England past Denmark 2-1 yesterday. The end of this game was fantastic. The championship match is going to be played on Sunday at Wembley Stadium. I don't think anyone really expected England to get this far. I actually do follow English soccer, you may be surprised to learn. Another disappointing team in the long list of roster of disappointing teams that I root for. So, hey, come on, England. Still ahead here. It's been more than 8 months since the 2020 election, but a Republican lawmaker and Trump ally is launching a plan to audit the results in Pennsylvania. We'll have those details coming up next.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Welcome back. Rudy Giuliani can no longer practice law in the District of Columbia, at least for now. A D.C. appellate court suspended his license yesterday after the New York appellate court did the same last month for making, quote, demonstrably false and misleading statements about the 2020 election while representing then-President Donald Trump. Under the rules of the D.C. bar, license suspension is required when a member is facing disciplinary action in another state. The former New York mayor may appeal to have his license reinstated. Meanwhile, more than 6 months after Congress certified that President Biden won the election, a Republican in Pennsylvania is looking for a recount. State Senator Doug Mastriano announced yesterday that he is asking for ballots and other election material in an attempt to launch an audit of the 2020 election, similar to the one still ongoing in Arizona. We should put audit in quotation marks. Mastriano is a close Trump ally who attended pro-Trump events in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. As chair of the state Senate Intergovernmental Operations Committee, he's requesting everything from election equipment to phone SIM cards and wireless router locks. In an interview, Mastriano pointed to the Arizona audit, quote-unquote, audit, as a model of what he wanted formed in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's Democratic Attorney General Josh Shapiro slammed the request on Twitter, writing in part, "This audit could risk decertifying the county's voting machines, costing county taxpayers millions of dollars." That is what happened in Arizona. Meanwhile, Georgia's controversial voting law will remain in place for now. It comes after a federal judge denied an effort to invalidate parts of the state's voting law yesterday. U.S. District Judge J.P. Boulay claimed that he wouldn't, quote, change the law in the ninth inning amid ongoing runoffs for the state house. The judge left open his judgment about future elections. The lawsuit by the Coalition for Good Governance, an election security organization, opposed new requirements that voters request absentee ballots at least 11 days before Election Day. The case also asked for the court's help to prevent restrictions on election observation. Early voting is currently underway for two state House seats ahead of Tuesday's Election Day. All right, still ahead here, President Biden takes a jab at Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell for touting the benefits from a COVID relief bill that he didn't vote for. But before we go to break, we want to know, as always, why are you awake? Email us your reasons for being up and watching to Way Too Early at MSNBC.com or drop me a tweet at Casey. Use the hashtag Way Too Early and we'll read some of our favorite answers coming up later on in the show. Way Too Early. It is nearing 5:30 here on the East Coast, 2:30 out west. I'm Casey Hunt. President Biden is set to speak today about the escalating tensions in Afghanistan, where the Taliban is reasserting power while the U.S. works to bring all American troops home by September. The president's comments will come just days after the U.S. pulled all troops out of its main military base in Afghanistan, Bagram Airfield, after 20 years. This while concern grows about the resurgence of Taliban forces there, who've been emboldened by the U.S.'s decision to leave. It's estimated that the Taliban now control one-third of the 421 districts in Afghanistan. Back here at home, during a trip to Illinois yesterday, President Biden called out Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell for touting the American Rescue Plan during a recent trip to Kentucky. The $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill passed earlier this year without a single Republican vote. Here's what the president said, along with McConnell's comments about the bill earlier this week.
Mitch McConnell loves our programs. You see what Mitch McConnell said?
So you're going to get a lot more money. I didn't vote for it, but you're going to get a lot more money.
He told me he wasn't going to get a single vote in order to allow me to get, with the help of everybody here, that $1.9 trillion tax cut, program for economic growth. Look it up, man. He's bragging about it in Kentucky.
In Kentucky, you'll get close to $700 or $800 million.
It's a great thing for Kentucky. It's getting $4 billion to help poor. That's amazing.
If you add up the total amount that will come into our state, $4 billion. My advice to members of the legislature and to others, local officials, spend it wisely.
That's a clip and tweet montage right there. Joining us now, White House reporter for The Atlantic, Peter Nicholas. Peter, it's great to have you here on set. Thanks for being up early with us. And I know you recently interviewed Mitch McConnell. It's pretty amazing to watch that because I do think it encapsulates something that you captured in your piece, which is that he doesn't care if there's hypocrisy there. All he cares about is winning. And he goes home to Kentucky and he says, hey, you know, I got some stuff for you, even though I said no.
Well, yeah, I think for Mitch McConnell, the game is what's most important. And he plays it well. He's been playing it for a long time. Sometime in the next 2 years, he's going to eclipse Mike Mansfield's record as longest serving Senate leader in American history. And I think he's thinking a little bit more about his legacy. So I spent some time with him. It was very interesting to see how he thinks about politics. It's very much a game of winners and losers. And he wants to be on the winning side. He uses football analogies. Being majority leader is like being offensive coordinator. Minority leader is like defensive coordinator. Talks about disputes on Capitol Hill as being like shirts and skins. Very polarized, very divided. So it's no surprise that, you know, he's going to, on the one hand, oppose President Biden trying to, pass this infrastructure, COVID relief package. But by the same time, tell his constituents, hey, this happened. It's good for Kentucky. It's kind of playing at both sides there.
Yeah. And in fact, we've got a nice excerpt from the piece. Yeah. It's called, What Does Mitch McConnell Do Now? And Peter writes in part, For McConnell, politics is sport. He's won and lost and is now aiming to recapture his old title of Senate Majority Leader in the 2022 midterm elections. If you're a football fan, it's like the difference between being the offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator, McConnell told me. The offensive coordinator has a better chance to score. But for many Americans, rarely has politics been less of a game. Any long view of McConnell's tenure would dwell more on what he's blocked than what he's built, what he's against, not what he's for. When I asked Republicans close to McConnell what he cares about the most, it was striking how little they mentioned policy. They talked instead about his fixation on winning the game. So, Peter, I mean, my one question about this, and, you know, I've covered McConnell for quite a while now, and he's one of the most interesting, if not the most interesting figure on Capitol Hill. During January 6th itself and in the wake of it, leading up to the certification, McConnell thought a lot about whether he was going to vote to impeach President Trump. He made a searing speech against him that talked about just how much damage was done to the Capitol in the wake of that. But since then, he's taken steps back. He has, he blocked the commission to investigate January 6th. Did you get a sense of how he's thinking about January 6th in the context of history and his long game and did he almost go over that edge in opposing Donald Trump or voting to impeach him?
Well, I think what he's shown is that I think he was thoroughly repelled and disgusted by what happened on January 6th. He spoke eloquently about former President Trump's culpability and complicity in that and encouraging and rousing that mob. But I think what he's also very focused on the midterm elections. And he has decided he needs to coexist with the Trump movement, that he can't alienate those voters. And that's what's key to getting Republicans back in the majority in the midterm elections. It's key to McConnell becoming majority leader. So you can't find consistency here because there's none. What you have instead is somebody who is thinking in very pragmatic terms about not alienating the Trump movement. So he gave what I thought was a very eloquent speech on January 6th, talking about how overturning that election, not certifying those results, would be poisonous to democracy, but then reverted back to the party tactician that you and I have seen over the years.
Right. So what does that say to you about how he's thinking about his own legacy? Because I felt like in those moments, you know, when we were all, and I was at the Capitol on January 6th, when we were all watching to see, were they going to get back in the chamber? And McConnell was one of the loudest voices saying, right, we have to get back in there. We have to demonstrate that we can still govern this country. Has he decided that he doesn't want his legacy to be defending that? He just wants to win again?
I think so. I think, you know, if you talk about legacy, I mentioned Mike Mansfield, who was a Senate Democratic leader from Montana in the 1960s. Mike Mansfield helped pass the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act in the mid-1960s. He helped Lyndon Johnson do that. That's a record. That's a legacy. I mean, those are serious accomplishments for a Senate leader. What is Mitch McConnell's legacy? You have to wonder at this point, because as I mentioned in the piece, it's about blocking things, about obstructing things. He's going to be remembered for opposing campaign finance reform when John McCain wanted to pass a sweeping bill to rid our system of political system of money. You know, is that really a legacy? He blocked the Supreme Court justice that nominee that Barack Obama put forward.
I think he'd point to that as his legacy, probably.
Yeah, yeah. And now he might do it again if Republicans are in charge or get the majority in the midterm elections. So I think he is thinking about his legacy, but right now it's not shaping up to be something as influential and substantial as, for example, Mike Mansfield.
So let's talk a little bit about what happens next here, because the bipartisan infrastructure bill that's on the table, obviously he's allowed these Republicans to enter into these negotiations, or at least, you know, tacitly approved that process. Rob Portman is part of that. He's very close to McConnell. McConnell has also pretty much said out loud, look, this is only going to happen if I sign off. Yeah. So what's the political calculation behind his thinking? I mean, is it we do this and that helps us in the midterms, or is it I need to stand in the way of this, or is it leaning toward I need to stand in the way of this to prevent Biden from getting the win?
I think you have put your finger on the question, because it cuts both ways. I mean, as we saw from the clip that you showed, he wants to get some pork back for Kentucky voters. That's important to him. But he also wants to deprive Biden of a win. I mean, if Biden passes an infrastructure bill on top of the COVID relief package and maybe passes the family plan, you're talking about a substantial legacy there. What a record that Biden has going into 2024. I mean, that's New Deal type stuff. I mean, that's big stuff. I think there's a part of Mitch McConnell that does not want to see that happen, that wants to weaken Joe Biden and soften him up for the 2024 elections. So I think that that's at work. But that's in conflict with the retail politician in him that wants to go back to Kentucky and say, hey, we've got this pork coming your way.
Right. And who knows that he's got a group of senators that have to run for re-election, races Precise. That right, he wants to win, where they can say the same thing. The Atlantic's Peter Nicholas, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I highly recommend the piece to anyone who has not yet had a chance to read it in The Atlantic. All right, still ahead here, the totally different reason one lawmaker's wardrobe could become an exhibit at the Smithsonian. Way too early. Back in just a moment. Welcome back. Time now for something totally different. Congressman Andy Kim of New Jersey made headlines earlier this year when a photo circulated of him quietly cleaning up the U.S. Capitol at midnight on January 6th after the attack, still wearing his suit. Now, Kim is donating that blue suit to the Smithsonian Institution, which is collecting items from the insurrection. Kim told NBC in a statement, quote, I unfortunately was at the site of one of the most tragic events in our American democracy. I hope other Asian Americans see in that suit the same thing that I see, which is hope for the kind of future in this country that many of us either immigrated to this country for or grew up in this country with. And now this, Bill Gates and Melinda French Gates have come to an agreement regarding their foundation in the wake of their high-profile divorce announcement. The two will continue their roles as co-chairs, but if, after 2 years, they can't find an amicable way to work together, Bill Gates will take over in full. He would buy Melinda French Gates out and provide her resources to do her own philanthropic work separate from the foundation. The Gateses also have agreed to increase the number of trustees. Currently, they and Warren Buffett are the only trustees, and Buffett announced plans to resign as a trustee in June. And 36 states and the District of Columbia filed suit yesterday against Google in an antitrust challenge to the company's control over its Android app store. According to Politico, the suit is the latest challenge to the search giant's plan to force all app developers who use its Google Play store to pay a 30% commission on sales of digital goods or services. The case mirrors a barrage of antitrust class actions filed on behalf of app developers and consumers who allege Google's policies have led to higher prices. Google responded to yesterday's suit, saying it isn't about helping the little guy or protecting consumers. It's about boosting a handful of major app developers who want the benefits of Google Play without paying for it. Google is also currently facing a Justice Department lawsuit over its efforts to dominate the mobile search market. And finally, the world's tallest sandcastle has been completed in Denmark. At 69 feet tall, can you imagine? It is 11 feet higher than the previous record-holding castle. The sandcastle's artist said its intricate design was inspired by the pandemic. Adorning the top of the sculpture, like a Christmas tree star, sits a coronavirus bacteria, illustrating how the virus is ruling our world, according to the artist. The castle is expected to remain standing until next February. How do they protect it from the rain? I have a lot of questions. All right, still ahead here, a celebration of heroes in New York City honoring its essential workers. And as we go to break, let's take a look at this date in history. 32 years ago, the inauguration of Argentina's new president marked the country's first transfer of power from one democratically elected civilian leader to another in six decades.
The new president, Carlos Menem, delivered a sober acceptance address in which he warned that cruel choices lie ahead. He said Argentina will die unless the people unite to help rebuild a nation broken by inflation, divided by political dissent, and threatened by social unrest.
Cheers erupted from downtown Manhattan as New York City held its first ticker tape parade in 2 years yesterday, honoring the essential workers who guided the one-time COVID-19 epicenter through the pandemic. It's amazing to see these images from New York after such a hard year. Through those clouds of confetti, about 2,500 people paraded along the Canyon of Heroes, led by Queens nurse Sandra Lindsay, the first American to receive the vaccine. There were 14 floats representing 260 groups of workers, including first responders, healthcare workers, grocery staff, educators, sanitation and transit workers, and many others, making it one of the biggest ticker tape parades in the city's history. And no one deserves this celebration more than all of those essential workers who stayed at it through such an incredibly hard time for everyone. Thanks to all of them. All right, let's go to politics now. One day after new results showed former police captain Eric Adams maintaining his lead in the New York City Democratic primary for mayor, his top opponents conceded yesterday. Former City Sanitation Commissioner Catherine Garcia and former counsel to Mayor Bill de Blasio, Maya Wiley, both accepted defeat, bringing an end to the high-profile primary.
This campaign has come closer than any other moment in history to breaking that glass ceiling and selecting New York City's first female mayor. We cracked the hell out of it, and it's ready to be broken, but we have not cracked that glass ceiling.
And for every woman and girl of every race and every community that saw so many powerful, smart, connected, grounded women who had the courage to stand up and say, we count and we lead, I congratulate every last one of them.
Adams will now go on to face the winner of the Republican primary, Guardian Angels founder Curtis Sliwa, in November's general election. And you can hear more from the Democratic candidate for New York City Mayor, Eric Adams, when he joins Morning Joe later today. Let's bring in veteran political strategist Susan Del Percio, who has a lot of experience with New York politics. Susan, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much for being here. We finally had a quick wrap up to an incredibly, incredibly drawn out process. Where do we go from here in New York? And what does this result actually tell you, if anything, about the national environment? Do you think it applies or not?
It's a little hard to say it will apply because it was such a unique situation, Casey, in that we were doing ranked choice voting for the first time in New York City. And even though we heard a lot of people saying, oh, it was the first time, which is why it took so long to get the results, that wasn't actually quite right, because mostly because of our arcane election laws. But what I learned from this race, and it shouldn't come to many people's surprise, is that New Yorkers are pragmatic. Crime was the issue. And it wasn't just hearing about the statistics. It was that subway violence, more than almost anything else, that really stuck out day after day, and the way Adams attacked that problem. And he did it from a law enforcement background, and yet saying you can still have progressive policies in policing. But it was, that is what stopped New Yorkers in their track the last 6 months. You know, you can get on, you can get out of Penn Station, but when you're greeted with filth and accosted, it's problematic for New Yorkers to go back to their everyday work. I mean, that parade shows you how wonderful New Yorkers reacted, and they want a city that they feel safe in.
Yeah, for sure. Susan, in the hours since Eric Adams was declared the nominee and therefore, you know, the likely next mayor, he has already attacked Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, asking why the gun violence emergency declaration took so long. Now, Cuomo's team naturally took this opportunity to blame Bill de Blasio, the outgoing mayor of New York. But, you know, this relationship between the mayor and the governor is just such a fascinating one in New York politics. What do you think Adams' relationship, presuming that, he does actually get elected in November, will be like with Cuomo?
Probably just as fraught as every mayor's relationship with Governor Cuomo and other governors. It is a unique situation, the New York City mayor and the governor of New York, mostly because being the mayor of New York City is almost seen as being more high profile. But that being said, let's not forget, Adams is coming in on a big win. And Cuomo is still facing multiple investigations. A lot of people say this emergency that Cuomo declared on gun violence was simply a way of shifting the conversation away from his own woes, which are now coming out again as the investigations continue. Eric Adams is going to be a thorn in Cuomo's side and vice versa. But I don't think that Cuomo will be able to fight Adams in the same way he went after de Blasio. And that will be go against Cuomo's grain. But I think Eric Adams is going to bring a whole new fresh perspective to New York City versus Bill de Blasio.
You know, I was just going to ask you, I mean, why do you think it is that Cuomo will have a harder time? I mean, Bill de Blasio, I understand, has his unique personality traits and challenges with Cuomo that particularly their personal interplay is particularly fraught. But it does seem as though Adams potentially brings to the table significant skills that, you know, could apply way beyond New York. I mean, I feel like I'd be surprised to see this be the last office he ever holds.
Well, it's always a unique thing when you look at the mayor of New York City and where they go from there. And it tends to be the last office they hold. but the relationship with Cuomo and Adams is also very important because as Cuomo has been weakened, his major support comes from the Black community and Black leaders. So he has to be careful how much he fights with Adams because Adams has that support and he can turn it on Cuomo, which could, again, be very problematic as Cuomo faces these investigations, especially by the New York State Assembly, who is looking into potential impeachment hearings.
That's a very interesting point. All right. Susan Del Percio, thank you very much for being up with us. As always, say hi to Uncle Murray for us, the dog who always loves to hang out with us. Earlier on in the show, we asked, why are you awake? One viewer tweeted, she's awake bathing our dog after she got sprayed by a skunk. Okay, that might be one of the worst reasons we've ever had anyone up way too early. I'm so sorry. Another viewer tweeted, I thought after my kids were old enough, I could sleep as late as I wanted. I was wrong. My body clock is apparently forever set for 3:30 to 5 a.m. Awesome. I think I'm going to be right there with you in the long run. And Paul tweeted this, I'm getting everything ready for a long weekend of hosting my wife's family for Christmas in July. Celebration due to COVID. 22 people. Yikes. Good luck. At least you can, you know, hang out outside if it's not Christmas. And I loved this note from Becca. She writes to me, I just found out Bryan Adams was 9 years old in the summer of 69, and I can't sleep knowing that the narration of my childhood was a lie. I had never thought about this before. I completely agree. Earth-shattering observation. All right, coming up next, we're going to take a look at the Axios One Big Thing and coming up on Morning Joe, where Eric Adams' plan for New York City policing stands with former police commissioner Bill Bratton. Plus, Congresswoman Lauren Underwood will join the conversation on the heels of President Biden's visit to her Illinois district. Don't go anywhere. Morning Joe, just moments away.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.